First case this morning is United States v. Ayala. Appellant ready to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Appellant may argue.
Good morning. Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Catherine Godfrey, and along with my co-counsel, Major Jody Grimm, we represent the appellant, Staff Sergeant Thomas Ayala. May I request 3 minutes in rebuttal?
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court made clear in McCaskey that evidence that merely shows that a witness said the same thing on other occasions when his motive was the same does not have much probative force for the simple reason that mere repetition does not imply veracity. But here the military judge fell prey to the illusion of veracity created by Specialist Diane's lies and his outright confusion of Military Rule of Evidence 801D1B. He first admitted text messages between Specialist AN and her mother without regard to the statement's threshold admissibility, correctness of the premise undergirding admissibility, or the statement's ability to in fact rebut the proffered charge. After clearly articulating the error in the analysis performed by the government and himself under 801D1B1, he then admitted Specialist AN's interview with law enforcement under Part 2 of the rule, without making clear findings of fact or law and in clear contravention of this court's holding in Finch. Acknowledging that he did not know how the rule functioned, he admitted the interview without providing explanation and prayed to counsel, let's see what happens. In so doing, he allowed the record.
He redacted portions of it, didn't he? I mean, he went over it. He let in what he thought should go in. And it's not like he let the whole thing in.
Correct, Your Honor. Out of 58 minutes of a video, he allowed in 45 minutes over specific objections by the defense counsel as annotated in Appellant 22.
I have no question that the error, if error, was preserved. The question, you know, he did redact, and we presume regularity on the part of military judges. So, if you just let the whole thing in, you might have a point, but he didn't.
Your Honor, he did not hold the government to its burden.
Could you speak up a little?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Yeah.
He did not hold the government to its burden as the proponent of the evidence to demonstrate how Specialist Ann's credibility had been attacked and the relevancy link between that prior statement and how it in fact rehabilitated her credibility on those specific points. Without doing so, he committed legal error.
Counsel, can I drill down for a minute on a specific point? So in the context of defense counsel referring to the fact that the prosecutor was permitted to attend the meeting with trial counsel and with victim, the defense counsel said, quote, all of this is going to lead up to me asking the victim, you know, did you then talk to the trial counsel about the questions the defense asked during the interview and prepare for how to answer those questions? Why wasn't it reasonable for the military judge to conclude that what was being argued there by defense counsel was that there was, in fact, prosecutorial coaching based on now the trial counsel knows what the questions are going to be, you then prepared your answers in collusion with the trial counsel? And if that is the case, why wasn't the prior statement admissible?
For several reasons, Your Honor. Defense's sole theory in this case, beginning in the opening argument, and that was woven through cross-examination, continued in their case in chief, and ended in closing, was that Specialist Ann had made this up from the very beginning. And Specialist Ann, to your point, Your Honor, specifically refuted that any preparation with the trial counsel had, in fact, somehow altered her testimony in any way. That's Joint Appendix 75. The defense also expressly disclaimed what the government's theory of what they were trying to do, and that's at Joint Appendix 120, 133, 159 to 161. And as this court did in Frost, reading the record in its entirety to see what defense counsel was doing, here the defense counsel made very clear that they were not suggesting that her testimony had been altered in some way, that it had not been improperly influenced, that she had not recently fabricated this story. It was simply to commit her to the fact that she had reviewed her statements and that she had practiced her testimony. And further, Your Honor, there's nothing improper about that. The rule requires even if there is an influence, it still be improper. And there is nothing to suggest, there's no allegation made, and it would be nonsensical to think that a complaining witness would not review her statements or practice with the trial counsel her testimony leading up to.
Captain Godfrey, my recollection of the record is that at some point the military judge actually agreed with defense counsel that defense counsel was not pursuing a claim that there had been an improper influence. Isn't that the case?
Correct, Your Honor, and that was approximately 100 and 150 pages after he admitted Prosecution Exhibit 4.
You can understand why I might not remember.
Yes, Your Honor. The record itself is entirely unclear as to what was happening. Things were changing. It sort of was like a stream of consciousness, not very clear rulings of what was occurring.
Right, but I guess, again, relying on my memory, as flimsy as it is, but my recollection is that after the military judge agreed with defense counsel, one of the problems is he never went back to correct his ruling or his reason for admitting the prior exhibit.
Correct, Your Honor.
So how was the prior exhibit admitted? I thought he admitted tell us what exhibits we're talking about.
Prosecution Exhibit 4 is the text messages between Specialist Diane and her mother, mm-hmm. and the military judge had admitted those under 801D1B1, mm-hmm. subpart 1 of the rule.
Let's call it small I and 2.
Small I. That works for me, Your Honor.
All right.
So in terms of that, though, with the mother's statements that were contained within the context of the overall exchange, were they actually being the mother's parts of it actually being admitted for the truth of the matter asserted, or is it simply being admitted because it provided context for the statements of the victim?
Your Honor, the military judge in several instances specifically explained that he was not considering the mother's statements for context, and then when he actually admitted portions of the mother's statements over defense's objections, they were being used substantively by the military judge. He was very clear. The one thing that is very clear throughout this record, whether it was under little one or little two of the rule, he was using this evidence substantively as truth of the matter. Turning to part two of the rule, the military judge's rationale was incorrect based on this court's holding in Finch. He articulated at Joint Appendix 167, it's a consistent statement, and the rule says if you attack her credibility, they get to rehabilitate her. They get to rehabilitate her credibility as a witness when it's attacked on another ground. And this is clear error in light of Finch. And while several grounds were articulated by the government at Joint Appendix 162 and 164 as to how her credibility had been attacked, they failed to link how specifically those prior consistent statements would in fact rehabilitate her credibility on those points. Some of the grounds that the trial counsel reached for were impeachment by character, by showing misconduct, or bad reputation. And those were the types of statements or attacks on credibility that the Supreme Court in Tome said were excluded from the weighty non-hearsay status afforded to prior consistent statements.
Captain Godfrey, the crux of your argument is that, and I realize the military judge nor the CCA did not have the benefit of Finch at the time, but is the crux of your argument that another ground does not mean any ground?
Correct, Your Honor.
In part two on it.
Correct, Your Honor. And while this court discussed the drafter's analysis, which noted inconsistency or faulty memory in Finch, the court did not limit those grounds to just those grounds. Some additional grounds that were considered or proposed by the government at 162 and 164 to illustrate this point further is that Specialist AN had received victim advocacy training. Now, this is a dispute of whether this is even an attack on credibility per se. This went to their broader point that she was essentially better poised to make a compelling complaint because she received this training. and introducing a prior consistent statement, a prior statement where she said she received victim advocacy training, was not doing anything to rehabilitate her credibility on that point. As this court pointed to in McCaskey, sometimes if there is an attack on credibility, the most effective vehicle for rehabilitating that credibility is through redirect. And the government did not do that on that point. Further, the military judge recognized how prejudicial these statements were in that he bookended his comments or the discussions of the text message with the mother and the interview with law enforcement by clearly stating he would not have admitted the statements had it been a trial before members.
But why does that suggest it's prejudicial to him and from his point of view? Isn't he simply saying that if there were members here, I might not have because they might misuse the evidence? I, the military judge, know the law, and I know I won't misuse the evidence.
Your Honor, respectfully, the military judge made very clear that he did not know what he was doing and loses deference that
he knew what he was doing when he said that, didn't he?
He admitted the mother's statements substantively without doing any kind of threshold admissibility analysis.
Right, but you're complaining about what he said with regard to his contrasting his admission of admitting the evidence in a jury trial and admitting the evidence in a Judge Loan trial.
Specifically, a Joint Appendix 120, Your Honor, he spoke of the difficulty of parsing out before panel members what would be appropriate and what would be inappropriate.
Suggesting that he could do that.
Correct, Your Honor, except he did not do that. And he did
not. How do you know? You were back there deliberating, weren't you?
Because he did not require the government to link specific statements contained within either the text messages or that interview with law enforcement as to how that did, in fact, rehabilitate her credibility.
So that goes back to your initial complaint that, hey, look, 2I doesn't allow you to bring in any, based on any attack on credibility. It's another ground, and that specific ground must be relevant to the kind of impeachment being employed. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor. And he used all of this evidence substantively as truth of the matter asserted to actually prove that Staff Sergeant Ayala sexually assaulted Specialist A.N. So when he went back to deliberate, he was not limited to her in-court testimony. He started with that. He had Prosecution Exhibit 5, the text messages, unredacted between Specialist A.N. and Sergeant Rolf. Then he had Specialist A.N.'s text messages to her mother's characterization of what happened to her, as well as a 45-minute-long interview with law enforcement.
Right, so, but didn't he also have before him and had, in fact, witnessed the victim testified, did he not?
Correct, Your Honor. However, the government offered the interview with law enforcement because it provided greater detail than Specialist A.N. had provided on the stand.
Why is that prejudicial from the military judge's standpoint?
Because it is...
He has more background to assess the victim's testimony.
Correct, Your Honor. However, the military judge was not here just acting as the referee of evidence. He was acting as a fact finder. So he was considering additional facts that had not been before him, and that was completely improper.
Okay. So what about the fact that the accused indicated that he, in fact, had crossed a line during that interaction with the victim here? Wasn't that fairly compelling evidence that he had engaged in the charged misconduct?
Your Honor, as defense counsel drew out during cross, the pretext conversation, so to speak, with Staff Sergeant Ayala that Specialist A.N. had was not very complete, and those statements of crossing a line could have meant a number of things, such as he recognized he was an NCO and she was junior enlisted. He was married and she was not. He was in a mail room after hours, 2200 by camp policy. Someone of the opposite sex could not be in his room. They could get in trouble for that. So not so simple as he crossed a line equals I sexually assaulted you. It could have meant a number of things, Your Honor.
Captain Godfrey, I hate to belabor this point, but you know how I am. And could you finish this sentence for me? the admission of this evidence was prejudicial because the military judge did what?
He was able to consider...
On the prejudice issue.
He was able to consider inflammatory, cumulative evidence for the truth of the matter asserted that was improperly admitted and should not have been before him as the fact finder.
Thank you.
Can you just expound upon the point why it was inflammatory?
In particular, Your Honor, the mother's comments characterizing what had happened to her daughter as being wrong, the military judge was able to use that as proof that she had been sexually assaulted. And while, you know, courts exclude statements because mere repetition does not imply veracity, the military judge remains human. And hearing repetition of the same story, as well as a characterization from the victim's mother, who did not testify at trial, saying to him what happened to her daughter was wrong, a judge is still susceptible to that.
Did you just say military judges are human?
I did, Your Honor.
I have nothing for you.
Judge Ryan.
Yes, Counselor, if I could just clarify. So is your position that that your position at trial, or the appellant's position at trial, was that she lied from the beginning, and so anything afterwards that also said that she was a liar was not admissible?
Correct, Your Honor.
I mean, basically, you can't bolster a liar's statement by the fact that she repeated the same lies later.
Correct, Your Honor.
And I guess one final question. Is there any distinction between military rule of evidence 801 D1B and the federal rules of evidence?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
My time is about to expire.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, and may it please the court. Captain Kyle Wells, and along with Major Craig Shapiro, we represent the United States. This court should affirm the Army Court's decision because Specialist Ann's text message to her mother, Prosecution Exhibit 4, properly rebutted the defense counsel's implication that her pretrial preparation influenced her testimony. And her video recorded interview, Prosecution Exhibit 14, rehabilitated her credibility after it was attacked on another ground, specifically through multiple purported inconsistent statements. Finally, even assuming error, the appellant did not suffer material prejudice to a substantial right.
Captain, can I hate to jump in early and disrupt your argument and let you continue, but what about my question to your colleague about at some point the military judge agreeing with defense counsel that the first exhibits that they talked about, I think those were the text messages, were admitted under one eye, let's call it. And he later agreed with defense counsel that, well, maybe that's not an improper influence. And therefore, what? Did he ultimately admit them under two eye, or what happened there?
Your Honor, he admitted the text messages to the mother under part one, mm-hmm. and the video recorded interview under part two.
Right, but then there's this later conversation between him and the defense counsel where he seems to be agreeing with defense counsel that the prior exhibit, or the reasons for the impeachment regarding the prior exhibit did not go to the issue of improper influence. You know what I mean?
I believe so, Your Honor. And the military judge started looking at whether or not the prior consistent statements proved that there was no improper influence. And this court in the United States v. Faison said that's not the point of 801 D1B1. It's not the issue of disproving the improper influence. The issue is whether or not you rebut the charge. And here the military judge's findings of fact, which this court will review whether or not they're clearly erroneous, support finding that there was an improper influence from defense counsel's questioning. And I'll point to multiple instances in the record that support that finding. It started before trial at J 27 to 28, where defense counsel highlighted to the military judge that the trial counsel was present for the defense counsel interview based on the trial counsel approaching Specialist A.N. and asking if she wanted him to be present. It continued before trial at J 31, where the defense counsel stated, I don't want to cast aspersions, but I can't imagine the trial counsel not asking Specialist A.N. about her relationship with another soldier, with Sergeant Rolfe. And then if we look at cross-examination, the first four pages from J 72 to 75 were solely focused on pretrial preparation and what she did with trial counsel to prepare. It wasn't a passing reference.
If I can interrupt you, please. Was there ever a suggestion that trial counsel asked her to change her testimony? That the trial counsel asked her to testify differently?
Your Honor, not in those expressed terms, but I would point the court to J 134.
So if trial counsel asked her and coached her and discussed with her testifying consistently with what she had said in her pretrial interviews, how does that fit under the rule?
Your Honor, the implication was the same as in Faison, Morgan, and Allison, where in Faison this court stated, on several occasions counsel suggested to the victim that her testimony had been shaped after her initial accusation of appellant by government counsel. Here, what the defense counsel did, and I point specifically to what Judge Olson was referencing to at J73, where when defense counsel was responding to an objection and they talked about the trial counsel being present in that pretrial interview, and they said that the line of questioning was going to lead to the defense counsel asking Specialist A.N., did you then talk about the questions the defense counsel asked during the interview and prepare for how to answer those questions? The implication from that line of questioning is clear. Specialist A.N. and the trial counsel were going to go back and essentially war game how to answer those questions, the questions that defense presented during their interview. That's the only point. And to distinguish this,
where is the fabrication?
Your Honor, if we're talking about inconsistencies, I point the court to JA-134, where the military judge said the implication from some of your questioning was that there was a difference between trial testimony and between her prior statements. Because Specialist A.N. has had an opportunity to talk to the trial counsel in preparation for trial, and you've only had one chance to talk to her.
But counsel, that's going to be the case in every case. Right? I mean, in every case, witnesses are going to be talked to by counsel, right? That are putting them on, don't you think?
They are, Your Honor, but in this case, defense counsel made a point. They opened the first four pages. In the first four pages, they had 16 questions related to pretrial preparation. They interjected this influence, and they didn't just interject it. It was the whole focus, the entirety of their focus, of the initial cross-examination. I would compare it to United States v. Morgan, where in United States v. Morgan, appellant contended before this court that there was only one fabrication, and that was that she had the victim had been coached from the beginning. But this court said, actually, there's two. There's two influences. One was after the Article 32 hearing. So this court stated in Morgan that we are satisfied at a minimum that the prior consistent statement in Morgan, it was a videotaped interview, rebutted the most recent improper influence. And in Allison, this court also talked about trial counsel shaping the victim's testimony, stating at one point defense counsel suggested that the victim had been influenced by trial counsel's pretrial interview and that the video recorded interview rebutted the suggestion that trial counsel may have shaped the testimony. And in Allison and in Faison, this court used the word shaped the testimony between the Article 32 investigation and trial. And in Morgan, this court highlighted that by stressing the victim had told her story over and over again, counsel raised the specter that improper influence had occurred after the Article 32 hearing.
So, counsel, if I can just make sure I understand your position. So if the defense says she lied at point in time A, right, and then she meets with trial counsel, and defense's position is she's lying now, and she says the same thing, in your position, in your view, you can repeat all of these things to show that she's not a liar?
Your Honor, it's rebutting the implication that pretrial preparation influenced her testimony. And it's rebutting it because it occurred hours after appellant's assault, 13 months before defense counsel met with Specialist A.N. in the pretrial interview. So it's rebutting the improper influence, the implication of improper influence that defense counsel raised repeatedly throughout trial. And it continued through closing, where defense counsel, when attacking Specialist Ann's credibility and her statements before the military judge who testified at trial, said, we know about Specialist Ann's preparation both before and after her interview with defense, again highlighting that she was preparing on how to answer the questions, how to go through cross-examination with trial counsel after the defense counsel's interview. And in Allison and in Morgan, this court talked about defense counsel can raise multiple influences. And the prior consistent statement only has to precede the improper influence it is intended to rebut. Here, Specialist Ann's pretrial prep has absolutely nothing to do with her other motives to fabricate. Defense counsel is saying she's lying because she's concerned about rumors about her reputation, about being in appellant's room after hours, about prior counseling statements. Those are motives to fabricate that occurred prior to her statements. They don't have anything to do with the trial counsel influencing her testimony in later preparation. This is not the same as in Frost, where the mother's influence started before the statements and continued all the way through the interview with Dr. Landry. And I highlight that this court stated in Frost that during the cross-examination of the mother, defense counsel only asked one question about Dr. Landry. Here, it wasn't a passing reference to pretrial preparation. It was the focus of their initial cross-examination for 16 questions over 4 pages of the record. And if we look at the military judge's findings of fact, which this court reviews to determine whether or not they're clearly erroneous. At JA-123, the military judge determined and stated, there was a fairly bald implication from defense counsel that the trial counsel was somehow manipulating what Specialist AN was going to testify to at trial in the days leading up to trial. And that continued to JA-172, where the military judge told defense counsel, the implication from your questioning was that there was an influence from pretrial preparation. And defense counsel said, I don't disagree. I don't disagree that we were saying that there was an influence from pretrial preparation. Defense counsel doesn't get to raise the influence or raise the implication or the charge and then dictate to the court what that implication is. Based on the rule, it's an objective determination of what fairly arose from the line of questioning, from the attack employed by the defense counsel. And here it's clear.
Counsel, do you have a case from a federal circuit that stands for the proposition that you are presenting to us?
Your Honor, I apologize. Could you repeat that question?
Yes. I asked whether you had a case citation from a federal circuit that is on all fours with the proposition that you are arguing to us today.
Your Honor, as to the I'm not sure I fully understand the question, Your Honor. I apologize.
Yeah, so as to your suggestion that her conversations with the trial counsel prior to testifying falls under 801D1B little I.
Well, Your Honor, I believe it's this court's opinions that best support that proposition, specifically Faison, Allison, and Morgan, where this court in all three cases talks about the influence of pretrial preparation, both with government counsel, with trial counsel, or by stressing that the victim has repeated a story over and over again. Those three opinions from this court support the proposition that trial counsel can be an improper influence by defense counsel implying that pretrial preparation influenced or shaped a victim's testimony.
But in those cases, wasn't the issue that they were alleging that there was fabrication? Like that what she was saying now was different than what she said, as opposed to here where they're saying she said the same thing?
Your Honor, I think they're all under the guise of whether or not the interactions with trial counsel was an improper influence, because what they all say
right,
is...
But if she said the same thing before and she's saying the same thing at trial, how is there a change?
Your Honor, there's no requirement that there be a change. Inconsistencies, as this court pointed out in Finch, are covered under Part 2. In Finch, this court said that Part 1 deals with improper influences and motive to fabricate, and as the analysis to the MRE mentions faulty memory and allegations of inconsistency, those fall under Part 2. So there's no requirement for Part 1, and it wouldn't necessarily make sense to require a charge of inconsistency for Part 1 when this court has specifically stated that Part 1 is separate from the other grounds referenced in Part 2.
Well, yes, counsel, I understand that.
Um, Your Honor, if I can move now to part two to discuss Specialist A.N.'s video recorded interview that the military judge admitted. In this case, there are multiple purported inconsistencies that defense counsel raised both in opening, cross-examination, and then highlighted in closing. So I'd start with the military judge's finding of fact. At J134, the military judge said that there were portions of Specialist A.N.'s testimony where defense counsel showed that her testimony at trial was different from her prior statements. The defense counsel agreed. The defense counsel said, I agree. I totally agree with you, sir. At J168, the military judge asked defense counsel if they had attacked Specialist A.N.'s credibility, and they replied, absolutely. In opening statements, highlight the court to the court, J36 through 41, where three different times defense counsel said that there would be inconsistencies. First, defense counsel said with regard to whether or not Specialist A.N. thought appellant was interested in her, they said she'll perhaps obfuscate on that fact. With regards to whether or not she was forced into appellant's room at J38, they said there also might be different versions regarding whether or not she went willingly into appellant's room. And then at J41, defense counsel said to the military judge, you'll have the opportunity to hear, to judge her testimony against her prior versions. So the three specific inconsistencies that came up from J85 through 102 regard whether she had made different statements regarding whether or not she thought appellant was interested in her, whether or not she was forced into appellant's room, or whether or not she went willingly, and also whether or not she replied sure to appellant when they were leaving his room, whenever he suggested taking a more secluded route back to her room.
Counsel, let's assume for a moment that this court were to decide that, in fact, the military judge abused his discretion in allowing these statements in. Certainly not asking you to concede that point, I'm just saying for the sake of argument. Defense says that the admitted statements were highly inflammatory and cumulative. From the government's perspective, could you please address the issue of prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor. First, there's nothing highly inflammatory in either statement. So when the court was talking earlier with defense counsel about the statement from the mother, it's clear that that came in for context. On J125 and J126, the military judge stated three different times with regard to the mother's statement that he didn't need those for context. But also, Specialist A.N.'s statement in this exchange that defense counsel highlights, her statement is, I know. I know has no meaning in and of itself. You have to read the mother's statement before that to provide context to what Specialist A.N. meant when she said, I know. But starting, when they first started reviewing these statements at J124, the military judge and the trial counsel were only talking about Specialist A.N. statements. When they start reviewing it, it's only Specialist A.N. statements that they're even talking about. And in that exhibit, it's a 14-page exhibit, the military judge excluded at least six pages and excluded a large portion of others. So he went through in finite detail, line by line, determining, you know, what was appropriate to come in under Part 1 and what parts were not consistent. When we look at the video recorded interview, the military judge sustained all of defense counsel's objections to the content when it came to what actually he would review from the video. So he recognized that their hearsay objection, was preserved, but then sustained all, and that's where any inflammatory material, that's where it would have been in those defense counsel objections that the military judge sustained. I'd point the court specifically to the 15-minute to 15:30 mark where on Appellate Exhibit 22, the military judge sustained the defense counsel objection. That content of that particular portion was where Specialist A.N. stated that she had talked to another soldier, Corporal Garcia, and Corporal Garcia told her that appellant was not allowed to have other females, be allowed to be around other females or allowed to have them in his room. And I'm paraphrasing. The military judge sustained that. That's the content that would be similar to Finch, where the victim had made comments in her video recorded interview about the appellant in Finch not being allowed to be home when she had friends over. That content is not present here. So there's nothing highly inflammatory in either exhibit that would have caused prejudice to appellant.
What evidence would you point to that would indicate the government had a particularly strong case?
Your Honor, particularly Prosecution Exhibit 1 combined with Prosecution Exhibit 7, which is the email exchange that appellant had with the victim where he said, I think I crossed the line. And the Army Court, when reviewing his Prosecution Exhibit 1, which is his video recorded interview with CID, said that his admissions to CID were particularly damning in light of his emails with Specialist A.N. the day before and were highly probative both of his consciousness of guilt and ultimately of his guilt. But
now, is it consciousness of guilt of the charged offenses, or, as Captain Godfrey would argue and did argue, that in fact it was improper conduct in terms of having her into housing and so forth? How do we know that this was some type of acknowledgement of the actual charged misconduct?
Your Honor, earlier in those messages, and I'm paraphrasing, but Special Agent asked him, why do you keep bringing up rape? So it's clear that that conversation was not focused on a particular, like a fraternization type of charge. It was focused on a sexual assault type of allegation, because he said it's a career ender in those messages, clearly referencing that the focus of that email exchange and him saying he thought he crossed the line was not based on her being in his room after hours and potentially violating some local command policy, but him instead, the aggravated sexual contact that he committed against her.
Why couldn't that be interpreted as, why do you keep on bringing up rape? Yeah, maybe I crossed the line in terms of should not have flouted the rules, but why do you keep on bringing up rape? That's not what this was about.
Your Honor, I believe that was what Specialist A.N. said to appellant, not what he said to her. That's because he had come over to her housing unit before those email exchange and had talked about whether or not she'd heard rumors of some type of sexual assault offense. So it wasn't him saying that to her, Your Honor, from my understanding of the record.
Counsel, may I ask you a question that's a little unrelated, but could you respond to the points that the appellant makes in Part A of the reply brief? This has to do with the admission of the mother's statement. Some were excluded, but some were included. And from page 19 of your brief, you say that the military judge admitted the ones based on context. I guess the appellant's position is we don't know that. What do you have anything to add?
Yes, Your Honor. I think we know that based on the entirety of the military judge's discussion with trial counsel, specifically stating three times at J 125 and 126 that he didn't need the mother's statements for context. And the trial counsel multiple times saying that statements from the mother would only have been there for the effect on the listener or for a non-hearsay purpose. Finally, as I'm about to conclude, I would just highlight to this court, United States v. JAS for Part 2 is almost identical to this case where the Sixth Circuit held that the video recorded interview was properly admitted to rebut prior inconsistent statements. Chief Judge, Your Honor, I'm out of time, if I may briefly conclude.
Any other questions? Judge Ryan, any questions?
I have no other questions.
Your Honor, based on the fact that the military judge properly admitted both Prosecution Exhibit 4 and 14, and assuming error, there was no prejudice, this court should affirm the Army Court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Briefly, Your Honor. My colleague referenced this court's decision in Faison. However, this court's decision in that case did not involve 801D1B. That was a case where the military judge had admitted the statement, not under the rule, but more under the common law use, where he limited its admissibility to credibility purposes only. So it's not exactly on point. The court in that case concerned itself about the charge of the fabrication itself and not the timing, because it did not come in under the rule. To Judge Ryan's question about whether a federal circuit court has discussed this issue, point the court to United States versus Magnin out of the Tenth Circuit, where the court was faced with a very bold assertion by defense counsel that essentially all of the victims in a sex abuse case, their testimony seemed to align over a period of time and essentially implied that they had colluded in their testimony. And there the Tenth Circuit found, because there was no change in that testimony, the statement didn't allege how exactly the testimony was changed, there was no implication of a recent fabrication. Furthermore, the only way that a prior consistent statement would work under Part 1 in this case was that if the trial counsel, her meeting with the trial counsel, in some way caused her to fabricate the sexual assault. That's clearly not an allegation or an implication was made. And again, still the the influence itself must be improper. And here, as Judge Ryan said, it happens in every case where a complaining witness is going to re-review their statement or practice their testimony with trial counsel. There is nothing improper with that. The military judge still got this completely wrong, despite eventually realizing that it should not come in under Part 1 of the rule, because he, while the government alleged certain attacks on credibility, he never forced them to make that relevancy link to how the prior statements would, in fact, rebut her credibility. And lastly, to prejudice, Your Honor, Specialist AM was the only direct witness to testify about what had happened. You had the testimony of Staff Sergeant Kavanaugh, who rebutted her version of events, that he was the one who told her to leave the room, that he heard her being flirty and giggly with appellant, and that contradicted Specialist AM's testimony in court. And again, the military judge is not infallible. He is human. And hearing repetition after repetition after repetition of the same story, he came to believe this illusion of veracity. For the foregoing reasons, we respectfully ask this court to set aside the findings and sentence. Thank you.
Judge Ryan, any questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted. Court is in recess until 10:45.